I want to talk about some aspects of incompressibility. And we talk about incompressible rods, and basically the equations for rods are the richest source of systems of evolution equations with but one independent spatial variable. And so I want to say a few things about compressible rods, and compressible is not a synonym for being extensible. And then I want to say a few words about the analysis of their differential equations. And then I want to describe how you can get an exact theory for incompressible rods and how their analysis differs very strikingly from that for the compressible rods. Now, what is an example of an incompressible rod? Well, a rod made out of rubber. Rubber is essentially incompressible. Its volume doesn't change no matter what you do with it. Another example of an incompressible rod is an eel. An eel is a living creature, and living creatures are mostly water, and water is effectively incompressible. And so when you put a little muscle in there, you have another kind of incompressible body. So I'm going to basically limit my attention to planar deformations. And let me just briefly describe how these theories can be constructed. And you construct them by imposing various constraints. So here we have a two-dimensional rod. Its length varies from x equals 0 to x equals 1. Here is the x-axis. We identify a typical material point by its blue dot with its coordinates x and y varies from minus h to plus h. And then under the action of forces, this rod becomes some sort of, in this case, a two-dimensional body living in IJ space. The center curve that's shown in red becomes a planar curve. The cross-section shown in green becomes a green curve. And the material point, originally at x and y, goes to position p of x, y, and t. And to analyze this would present us with a nasty system of partial differential equations in two space variables and one time variable. And the purpose of rod theory is to simplify that somewhat and kill all but one spatial variable. And so we're going to characterize the configuration of this rod at any time t by this red curve and a vector b that characterizes what happens to the cross section. So the configuration is going to be this function r, which gives us the red curve. The position here is r of x and t, and the vector b of x and t. And we'll take b to be a unit vector. We'll also choose another vector perpendicular to b and call it a, and a and b make a right-handed orthonormal system, and a makes angle theta with respect to the horizontal. Now, we get different theories depending upon how we impose the constraints. The simplest way of getting a theory for compressible rods is assume that the position of any point at time t consists of this position on this red base curve and something that varies linearly with b. You can then jazz this up in many respects. For an incompressible rod, we will make a similar assumption. But instead of assuming that everything is linear in the thickness variable, we'll choose an unknown function beta that will characterize what's happening. And the only thing we request of beta is that it vanishes when y equals 0, so it will not affect the base curve. And our purpose is to choose beta such that p preserves areas. So to do that, we'll introduce a little bit of notation. A was the unit vector shown over there, cosine theta I plus sine theta j. B is orthogonal to it. We decompose R sub x with respect to this basis. And this quantity nu, roughly speaking, tells us about elongation. And mu, which is a sort of curvature-like term, tells us how much bending occurs. Then we simply take this assumption, the second assumption P, and choose the Jacobian for it, compute the Jacobian, and we get that it has nu minus beta times mu, so the length changes and the bending changes come into play, times the y derivative of beta. Well, this is just an ordinary differential equation for beta. Before we solve it, we know that if we chose beta to equal y, then the requirement that this Jacobian be positive, which says that you never can change the orientation, that you never can squash the volume down to zero volume, gives us this kind of inequality that nu is greater than h times the absolute value of mu, and it tells that these two strains, mu and nu, lie in this convex set, and that convexity helps make the analysis a little bit easier. For an incompressible rod, we simply choose this beta so that this Jacobian equals 1. That's an ordinary differential equation for beta. We solve the ordinary differential equation, and we get a bit of a mess. And we can write it as nu minus delta, where delta is this nu mass, which depends upon the thickness variable. And we can rewrite that in this alternative form. Once we have this beta, we can stick this back into our representation for P and compute all the various strain-like quantities. This is the members of the Cauchy-Green deformation tensor, and they are going to depend upon this delta, the nu that we have, the eta, which measures at the very top, that measures the amount of shear, and we have quite a bit of a mess there. The requirement that delta be positive, which we certainly want for geometrical reasons, we don't want this thing to get less than zero, says that nu squared has to be greater than this. That means that nu and mu lie in a non-convex set. Yes. Subscripts typically denote derivatives. Let me say a word or two about constitutive equations and three-dimensional elasticity. There are different kinds of stresses. One is the Piola-Kirchhoff stress. We assume that it has a part that represents the equilibrium response, namely it's a derivative of a scalar energy. That is really the elastic response. And then anything else that we want, we'll call this the dissipative part, and we ask that the dissipative part vanishes when the body has been in equilibrium forever in the past. All we're going to do is require that this thing be truly dissipative later on. So we'll choose those as our constitutive, general constitutive relations. So this is a general material that can be elastic, inelastic, or that about accommodates all those cases. I want to say a word or two about the compressible case, because I want to contrast what we're doing today with that. And we let N be a contact force, force communicated by one part of the rod to the other part, M be the contact couple. The equations of motion are the derivatives of N equals a mass per unit length times the acceleration term. Here is the couple equation, which is fairly simple in this planar setting, and we get a theta tt. And we again have the same sort of variables that we've introduced before. Now, basically, we'll take as our constitutive equations that N, this contact force, it consists of a part that is a derivative of an energy, that's the elastic part, another part that's a derivative of the energy, and a dissipative part. M is likewise a derivative of an energy plus a dissipative part. We stick this into the equation of motion, we get the energy estimate, or actually get them from the weak form of the equation. We get the kinetic energy plus the stored energy plus the work expression of the dissipative terms, which is this mess over here. And we simply will assume that this is greater than or equal to zero. The kinetic energy is certainly greater than or equal to zero. And this says that we have an estimate for the stored energy. Now, if we want to prevent material from being squashed down to zero volume, we might very well say we want the energy to get very large as the Jacobian goes to zero. And that is perfectly reasonable. And if W has this property and the integral of W is bounded, that says that W cannot be infinite on a set of positive measure. And that simply says that the inequality that we require has to be greater than zero almost everywhere. And that's not good enough to do any sort of analysis. And the unpleasant feature about these compressible rods is that you have to make some other assumption to prevent these kind of total compressions. And the technique for making the other assumption is to assume that the viscosity become very, very large as one gets near a total compression. That certainly makes sense, that things get stickier when you squash things down to zero volume. If you make that assumption appropriately, then it is a very simple computation, which I won't carry out, that simply uses the momentum equation and enables you to prove that there is an a priori bound preventing a total compression in that case. So it is the behavior of viscosity that prevents a total compression rather than the behavior of the energy. Once you have those inequalities, you can do a variety of existence theorems and so on, get nice global existence of solutions and so on. Now I want to go back to the incompressible rod theory. We have a representation or an ansatz for the position field. We have the strain fields. We get the equations of motion by putting in our ansatz into the principle of virtual power, or the weak form of the equation, depending upon your religious affiliation. And you get something quite complicated. This involves certain stresses, and these are integrals across the thickness. And the whole purpose of that little picture is to show you that things are complicated if you want to make the identifications of some of those integrals as resultant. You'll get a partial differential equation looking like this. We have 2x derivatives, and this quantity is going to depend upon our strains. It's going to depend upon our strain rates. And in this particular case, for viscoelasticity, it depends upon other stuff. But the strain is a derivative position, so a strain rate is a second derivative position. So this is really a fourth-order partial differential operator. It's a weird fourth-order partial differential operator. Now, many of the people who are looking at problems like coexistent phases and all sorts of instabilities in solids encounter lots of mathematical difficulties caused by these instabilities, caused by the lack of convexity. And the traditional doctrine is that when the second order equation behaves badly, you put in a biharmonic. The point is that people have been worrying themselves sick over 50 years about what are the real detailed constitutive equations for the original body. The treatment of putting a higher order term would be infinitely more difficult, and it is finessed by putting a biharmonic into it. Here, as a consequence of our incompressibility, we are given almost for free a mathematical structure telling us how to put the higher order derivatives in. And the presence of the higher order derivatives will, in fact, make everything go through. Now, one of the points I want to mention is that we don't have to worry about Lagrange multipliers because we had an exact representation of area-preserving deformations. If you make more elaborate models, the various approximations will give us non-local behavior in the x direction. So I'm going to restore my original equation here. We're going to take very simple boundary conditions. I'll flash them up in 1 second. That's it. We'll weld the left end of the rod to a rigid wall and leave the right end free, and we get various boundary conditions, which I won't oppress you with through the rest of the talk. So let me now summarize some of these equations that we have. We have our position field having this particular form. We solved an ordinary differential equation for beta. We had this mess delta. We have our x derivative r. And I guess the f should equal x. And we will make one assumption that the two-dimensional stored energy, phi, should depend upon these various components of the Cauchy-Green deformation tensor. I'm not even bothering to write down what the third one is. And so we are going to assume that there are numbers, each greater than 1, p, q, and r, a couple of positive numbers here, such that phi has a lower bound that has this form. And it has a lower bound depending only upon the entries that appear here. If we want to have an isotropic body, we choose P equal Q equal R. And I showed you what the differential equations look like, but we're not going to look at those. We're very simply going to just get an energy estimate. The energy estimate gives us our total energy, our stored energy, plus kinetic energy, plus the dissipative work. We will assume that the dissipative work has a positive lower bound. Kinetic energy has a positive lower bound, and so we'll start out with this energy bound. And what I want to indicate is that there are P, Qs, and Rs, rates of growth, such that this inequality prevents any sort of bad behavior on these quantities, that you can't squash any direction down to zero length, you can't pull any direction out to infinite length, and you get these from the purely elastic response of this problem, and it's basically independent of what happens to the rest of the material, no matter what the material behavior is, as long as the dissipative work is greater than or equal to zero, or in fact has a negative bound. Now, one of the reasons, why do we want the bounds? Well, first of all, they're essential for existence and regularity theory. They preclude certain classes of very ill-behaved solutions, therefore they preclude certain classes of shocks, and they also preclude unphysical behavior in numerical computations. There are cases where people have done beautiful, beautiful numerical results, and when they, if you look at them very carefully, the material has been turned inside out or something has been squashed too far, and it's very hard to discern those things simply from the looking at the numerical results. Okay, so what I want to do is give you a little example of how to get some of these results, and this is an example of calculus for adults. So in the light green, I'll apologize for that, I'll put a little bit lower, here is this energy in which we substitute this lower bound. And we get all this stuff is less than some function gamma. And I would like to have this one term, the absolute value of eta plus beta sub x. Those terms are sitting around, those terms are shown here, and I would simply like to separate those two effects. First of all, there's no way this theory will tell us about how the thing responds in shear. And so we want to get rid of that shear. If we made an appropriate assumption of dissipativity, we could actually get pointwise bounds on eta, but I don't want to use any further assumptions. So to go from here to here, I have to use a little lemma that I couldn't find anywhere, so here's the proof of it. So we have an n-tuple of numbers, which we call u. We have an n-tuple of functions, f. Y lives in some sort of measurable set omega, and A is some compact set in finite dimensional space. And we simply assume that f as a function of y is in LP, and f as a function of its second argument is continuous. And the dot product of these two things are exactly what we want. And the theorem says the following, that if the fk are independent, then there exists a c which can depend upon the vector f, but it's independent of alpha, such that the inner product raised to the p power is greater than or equal to u to the p power. Well, if u equals 0, the proof is obvious, and otherwise we set v equal to the ratio of u divided by its p norm, and then we observe that the pair v and a going into this function is continuous on the unit ball in LP crossed with a, has a minimum there, and for all v, the set of y's of positive measure, there exists a set of y's of positive measure such that this dot product can't vanish. Because if that dot product vanished almost everywhere, then the f's would cease to be independent, and that was our basic assumption. And so therefore, since that's the case, this quantity has to be positive for all v and alpha, and that gives us the requisite lower bound that we were seeking. Now, to exploit this theorem is a bit more of a pain, and so I'll just sort of sketch the things. We have this quantity, eta plus beta sub x, at the top in blue. We break it up into what beta really is, namely that mess. We will choose omega to be this interval minus h to h. And if we look at the top, we see y and y squared. Those are clearly independent. However, the delta depends upon y. And so that means that we can't quite use the result until we clean things up. So we'll take u's to be this triple, eta, and this quantity here, which is going to be independent of y, and this delta is going to be the smallest possible value. And then we choose our f's to be something that complements this with the property that all those things can be written as the usual dot product. And the alpha in this expression is mu divided by nu, and this has to live in a finite interval. And so these f's have the requisite bounds. We apply the lemma. The lemma gives us that we can separate out the eta from this other stuff. It's less than gamma. Since x to the p is convex, we have a nice little convex inequality that gives us beta of p is less than beta x plus eta. That should be somewhere under control. That's under control by our original energy estimate. Eta is under control, so we get beta x is less than that. And ultimately, we are able to separate things out into this form. Once we're in this form, we can chuck the eta because that won't appear in any of our other work. So at this stage, we now have this green inequality with the eta killed. And with that, we can now just get a lower bound on nu. Nu prevents any two different sections from coming together. And this will show you where the calculus comes into play. So we had an expression for beta. And we take the absolute value of that. It's 2y over this quantity. We use the fundamental theorem of calculus that equals its value at x equals 0, and then the integral from 0 to 1 of beta sub x. Then we integrate this left-hand side through the thickness. This is less than some constant. Here we have a double integral of beta, but the double integral of beta sub x is under control if we choose p equal 1. And so all this stuff is under control. This integral is greater than an integral over half its interval. And over this, over half its interval, we put in what the delta is this square root. And we can make things only worse by just putting a plain nu here, which is larger than this. And this is a quantity we can integrate. And so this quantity is less than gamma. We turn things upside down. We get a lower bound for gamma. And that tells us gamma has to we want to keep gamma away from the boundaries of this interval. This says gamma, we want to keep nu away from the boundaries of that integral. This says that nu has a positive lower bound, and so it keeps it away from part of the boundary. Remarkably, to get an upper bound on nu, it requires more effort, and I will sketch that as well. So here is the Hilder inequality, where alpha is the Hilder exponent. And to get an upper bound, we choose p greater than 1, and we have to fiddle with a second parameter, q, and we choose it so 1 over p plus 1 over q is less than 1, and the discrepancy is basically due to alpha. So alpha is a little number that counts for the discrepancy. And we start out again. We take nu plus delta to the alpha. We write that by the fundamental theorem of calculus as its value at the left end plus its derivative. But we write the derivative not to the alpha minus 1, but we write it to the alpha plus 1 times and put it to the 2 power down below. Having done that, we multiply this by twice the absolute value of y and continue this inequality. And here we use the Hilder inequality, getting this little piece, kicking it up to the q power, and this term, what's left? Well, what's left, this is just the derivative of beta sub x, and the Hilder inequality raises that to the p power. The p is less than gamma. And so we get this expression controlled basically by this thing right here. Now we have an upper bound for delta that comes from our original energy assumption, and we need to just control this nu. Don't forget this is a double integral over here, it's a single integral over here. How do we get a bound for nu? Well, we write out our delta, and our delta can be, we put our equations up on the board. The delta can be integrated explicitly. I'll put this here. The delta can be written explicitly, and when you get that explicit integration, then you can use the convexity of this function to simplify that even more. This gives us a lower bound for delta, and the lower bound actually involves a nu. So we get nu controlled by the delta, and when we put those all together, we go back here, we get our upper bound for nu. There are similar estimates getting more and more complicated to control all the quantities that take place. I will just show you them as a movie. We get a lower bound on the thickness. That is quite painless. To get a... to get lower bound for delta requires, again, just calculus, but the trick is to find out which calculus to use. And these computations, use the same ideas. Hilder inequality over and over, a little bit of convexity from time to time, and just making judicious choices of what you should do. So the basic upshot is that the incompressibility gives rise to much more complicated equations, and yet the elastic response or the equilibrium response by itself gives us all sorts of nice estimates to ensure that the solution is going to behave nicely, to prevent any sort of awkward kinds of shocks, and to guarantee that any sort of numerical results that you were trying to apply to these materials are going to be well behaved. There is a basic misunderstanding that arises often in applied mathematics that you observe from experiment that certain effects are small, and therefore, when you look at the governing differential equations, you can chuck out those terms, and because those terms are small when the solution is small. But those are the terms that keep the solution small, and you often run into difficulty. So by keeping these full, the full terms, you can ensure that the solution is going to be well behaved. Now, there is a certain revenge for all this, and that is that the equations are real bastards. And so, let me show you an example in which you get the revenge of incompressibility comes into play. So this is a very simple steady state problem. You have a shell, and since this is going to be an incompressible shell, it could be a hemispherical tennis ball, or it could be an orange peel, both of which are effectively incompressible, and you want to turn it inside out. And if you do that, you will notice, if you can turn it inside out, if it's thin enough, there's going to be a boundary layer near the edge, which is going to have a little bit of a lip. And one of the things we're interested in for the shell is to show that there is an everted state, one turned inside out, to actually compute the what's happening in the boundary layer, do it by asymptotics, but it has to be done by rigorous asymptotics, and to basically examine what's happening. One of the reasons this problem is of interest is that it is associated with snap-through buckling, one of the most difficult kinds of dynamical buckling there is, and it will give rise to certain equilibrium configurations to which you expect the solution to snap. So I'm looking only at axisymmetric shells. No one has done the non-axisymmetric shells, and in fact, no one really knows how to do it. The basic idea is the following, that if this were not a shell but a membrane, like a balloon, it's easy to find a solution that's inside out. You simply reflect it through the plane. And so the basic idea is that if there is a thickness parameter, then when the thickness is zero, if you're lucky, you have the leading term of a solution, and then you can hope to construct a solution with that as your leading term. And so if we appropriately scale the equilibrium equations for this shell, then this is what one of the equations look like, and this quantity depends upon various derivatives of strains. So this is really a fourth order operator here, and then there's all sorts of assorted garbage on the way down. And there are a few other equations just like that. However, I am not going to give you a test on that, so you don't have to study that very carefully. Oh, briefly, what I want to do is describe how you handle incompressibility in this case, say a few words about the justification, and a few words about how the asymptotics proceeds, or the formal asymptotics, and how you do the justification. A membrane, think of it as a shell with zero thickness, but it has no bending resistance. So again, it's just a balloon. And so we have a candidate for a leading term, namely the simple reflection through the plane. And the basic idea is, can we exploit that to get this very, very large deformation? The geometry is almost identical to that which I described earlier. You simply take a section of the shell and describe it in a similar way. The only variable that comes in is the distance rho from the axis of rotation. And the various other variables are the same, except there are a few more that have this rho coming into play. There's a second difficulty that anyone could expect, and that is there's a polar singularity at the North Pole, which is a real pain in the neck to handle. If we make an analogous ansatz for the position field, we assume that the position consists of position of some sort of reference surface or mid-surface, and then the effect of what's happening in normal direction, we can make an analogous assumption. Here the delta is epsilon squared, it's a small parameter. The incompressibility is namely that this Jacobian equal its original value. This gives us an ordinary differential equation. Xi is the variable through the thickness. This gives us an ordinary differential equation for beta sitting next to a beta squared, so we get a cubic equation for beta. And my operating philosophy is, yes, I know you can solve cubic equations, but I don't really believe it's possible. And so we just carry around the equation in its implicit form. Then we have this representation at our disposal for the position field involving the explicit or the implicit solution of this equation. And so we can compute all the strains that you need. All the strains depend upon bunches of variables. And we then give a shell theoretic stored energy, which is just the integral through the thickness. Now I've changed variables of some three-dimensional stored energy. When delta equals zero, that means you have zero thickness. Delta is epsilon squared, and that corresponds to no bending resistance. And then we simply, in this case, take the equilibrium equations, the Euler-Lagrange equations for this energy functional, and take natural boundary conditions. Nothing fancy there, and they are the mess that that one sees. We also have to have isotropy at the North Pole, because if we don't worry about that isotropy, we run into tons of difficulties. And this W that we have is convex in most of its arguments at the trivial solution when the thickness is zero, so that is the good news. So we want to do asymptotics. First of all, the formal asymptotics. We get a reduced problem, no thickness, that's the membrane, and we simply take the everted state. Then we choose the actual thickness is going to be written in terms of a new parameter, epsilon squared. And the reason for using epsilon squared is because in the boundary layer, the natural parameter is epsilon by itself, and we prefer not to use square roots. And we introduce a stretch parameter near the free edge. And then we have bunches of our variables. We assume our variables depend upon S, which is the simply the arc length parameter from the North Pole. And this gives us our regular expansion. We don't use the, I don't use the word inner or outer expansion because half the people in solids use them opposite from the fluids people. And then we have a boundary layer expansion. And then we have a technical expansion that just makes sure that nothing at the North Pole gets in really, really gets into the way, and we plug the regular expansion into the differential equations, which I showed you once, and just compute the expansions as long as your stomach can tolerate it. And then having a regular expansion to several terms, and you can actually compute it up to the fourth or fifth term by hand, you stick the whole expansion into the governing equations together with the boundary value problem and show that the boundary layer terms decay exponentially away from the edge. And you can observe that the first correction to the reduced solution is the boundary layer term. So the first thing that takes place from the mirror image is going to account for the lip near the boundary. And various nonlinear effects take place at the thickness squared. And the basic theorem is that if the data are sufficiently smooth, then for small enough thickness, the boundary value problem has a classical solution, and it can be approximated asymptotically by the nth order approximation to different powers depending upon how many derivatives you have. And the proof of this is dependent upon a modification of a result of Kantorovich, which is based upon an abstract version of Newton's method. It's in the book of Kantorovich and Akilov, for example. And this modification was done by Srupczyk and Udovich. Some of this work was done jointly with Srupczyk. And the basic idea is the following. You write the equilibrium equations as in the first line, and you assume that F is twice Fréchet differentiable. When the solution's near the exact solution. And then, again, if you recall Newton's method, you have to have control of F, the inverse of its linearization and the second derivative. If all this stuff is under control, then you are basically able to apply Newton's method and be assured of convergence. And the hard part is to study the linearization about the approximate asymptotic solution, because the approximate asymptotic solution is going to be something with a lip. And in particular, what you have to do to control it is to show that the solution of the linearized problem can be bounded in terms of any non-homogeneous term, and you can have epsilon to all sorts of bad powers. And the method of that is you linearize the equation, you dot the equation with appropriate variables, get energy estimates, you have a polar singularity at the North Pole, and you would expect Bessel or Gendre-type behavior at the North Pole, and then fiddle around and try and write your operator equation to properly account for the Bessel or Legendre-like behavior at the North Pole. You can capture the precise polar behavior, and if you do that right, then you can invert this problem and get all the requisite estimates. And we wrote it up in the Journal of Elasticity, and to have the abbreviated form took 19 pages published. This is the kind of thing that's best done in the privacy of your own home. Let me conclude with a statement of some open problems on these reversions. Sorry? Yeah, it appeared in the Journal of Elasticity about a year ago. Or they're fiddling around with the numbers, the years of the journal. It actually appeared about three or four months ago, but it was backdated. Now, there's some open problems here, which I'll mention very briefly. If you weld the edge to a rigid wall, here would be a typical shape, then the theory doesn't handle that. And the same thing happens if you want to do something that's really of use in the buckling of metal structures, where you develop a little dimple in an inverted state. That's perfectly reasonable, but you're having some weird stuff taking place right here. In fact, if you look at photographs of buckled beer cans, that is a pretty sharp edge. And the difficulty that I expect is that the form of the expression, when I wrote down an ansatz for the asymptotic behavior, it appeared in nice powers of epsilon. I suspect that if you do one of these problems, the powers of epsilon that appear, or more precisely the functions of epsilon that appear, are going to depend upon the material. So you get things that are independent of material if the boundary conditions are nice. Now, there's another problem for non-symmetric shells. So here is a green non-symmetric shell. And what is its reflected image? Well, if I reflect this across the red horizontal line, this is its reflected image. But there's no symmetry here, so I could reflect this thing through the blue skew line and get the reflected image, this blue thing. But which is the reflected image to start out with? I have some ideas on that, but that's basically wide open. And I strongly believe that these techniques will apply to the three-dimensional theory, and I'm working with Bernadette Miara on seeing if it goes through for the three-dimensional theory, but that, of course, is going to make these equations, which I dared not show you because of their complexity, make those look very simple. Thank you very much.